bear in mind that the hymn does not bear any resemblance to the message that I'm giving in some ways. It will in other ways, but anyway, it is something totally different. Perhaps you might find that I go into some details that you find particularly difficult to come in to grasp, or not necessarily to grasp, but to know concerning them. And it's about a particular subject, as you might have seen in that Peter put in the paper, something that we take for granted that we should never take for granted, because it is something that will affect most of us. Well, I think you remember, and the trouble is with the news, when it's either on television or in the paper, it's an item for the time being, and then it phases off when there's something else happens. And the event that I'm going to talk about at first was something that was blazoned across the world news and was very significant. Now, of course, we have something else, and then something else turns up, and something else, and some of them are related. In fact, a number of the items that come on the news are very much related to what I'm starting with. It happened in January this year, and it happened in Paris, which I went to last year, and it was a massacre of those who were involved with a particular newspaper, a very satirical newspaper. And the French people rose in support of the very fact and decried such a massacre, and they had the support of some of the world leaders, including David Cameron from the Prime Minister of Britain, Netanyahu from Israel, a representative from the United States, Angela Merkel from Germany, and nearly every European leader was there as well in support of the French people and their rights to freedom of speech after this Islamic massacre. And we have other events taking place like this around the world. And the West seems unable to seem to do much about it to stem the tide of this sort of thing. But their march in support was about the fact of the freedom to have the right of free speech, the right of liberty to assemble, the right to have the freedom of selecting your own religion, the right of not having a religion if that would be the case, the right of other liberties that you and I take for granted. We have them in this country, and I'm glad that we have them in this country. But when you go to so many parts of the world, people do not have these liberties. And these Muslim extremists were trying to dictate a lifestyle, a religious intolerance that was shown by them, such as we now are familiar with. And we look at them with horror. And we say to ourselves, we don't want this sort of thing, and neither should we. And what this was about, the French people protecting their basic rights, civil, religious, cultural liberty, liberty, equality, fraternity. And those words, they spoke out very definitely. They came from the French Revolution. They gained these liberties as a result of the French Revolution over 200 years ago. And they regard them as fundamental to their way of life. Now, I have never seen when I was in Europe, I saw such secularism as you would not believe. If you claim Australia is a secular country, it is nothing to what you see when you go to Europe. It is very, very very, very secular and very little religious, let me tell you. And Paris, I went into the great the Cathedral of Notre Dame. I went into some other cathedrals in Europe, including the Vatican. And let me tell you, very few people turn up at these events, at church services, believe me, very few. It's so secular you can't believe it to be the case. But at the same time, they have the right under God to liberty, equality, fraternity. The French people do. We have the right of liberty we have the right to assemble. We take these basic rights for granted. We have the right to join or not to join a union, whether you like that or not. But it's a right. We have the right to choose what religion we belong to, and we'll be able to worship that religion, or if we choose not to have a religion, not to worship. We take those things for granted. Most of our kids would not understand what I'm talking about in any other way and what they see at the present time, because they have been brought up in this. But if we go back 200 years or even far less than that, or if they went to some countries on earth, they would see what it was not to have these liberties and understand what the benefits of having liberty is. I'm going to talk about primarily the freedom of religious liberty. But there are other liberties that come from it. In fact, it was because of religious liberty we have the right to assemble. We have the freedom of the press, and I forgot to mention that. The freedom of the press is very vital too. The freedom to think differently, to have your own way of life, come as a result of religious liberty. Now, I want to go back in history, and this is where perhaps you might find me a bit difficult to follow. But I will go through a number of situations that reflect the issue of development of religious liberty. If we went back into Israel's time when Moses was given command or given control of the nation, actually he was just a spokesman. But if you lived in that situation, if you were going to be a person of Israel, you did not have religious liberty. Realize that. You were under a theocracy. There was one religion, that was the religion that God had given through Moses, who Moses was just a spokesman, but it was God's religion to the people. It was ordained by God. You either belonged to that, if you didn't, if you violated it, you were killed, or executed, or cast out. Either one or the other. And believe that and understand that, because that is the way in which it was the theocracy operates. And that's very much like what we see some of these extremists have the idea of. However, they were given the choice to either belong to Israel or not. When we come into the time of the apostles, and we take this from the number of the empires that existed before that, but the Roman Empire had the ideal of freedom of religion for many religions. And there were numerous ones, though nearly all of them were pagan. But people had the right to worship some of their gods as they saw fit, provided they didn't step out of line of what the Roman authorities desired. And so Judaism was accepted as a religion that you could belong to and worship. And other religions that were pagan religions. Rome had their own gods, and they gathered those from Greece, they gathered some from Babylon and so forth, which were part of their pantheon. And I've been in the pantheon, which has been taken over by more or less the religion of Roman Catholicism. But they had these various gods in this huge big building. But they had the right to worship. However, Christianity started to become a part of the Roman Empire. And at first it was very small, and the Romans didn't bother at all. But as you and I know, the first big clash came when Nero set fire to the city of Rome. And he wanted a scapegoat. And Christians were the ideal scapegoat. This was the beginning of, as we would say, religious intolerance, religious persecution of Christians began there in terms of the Roman Empire, particularly. And this was Nero's first attack of the state, banning a particular religion and enforcing the conformance of the people against following that religion. And of course we had the number of martyrs, etc. and so forth. But do not get the impression that from Nero on, that every Roman emperor persecuted Christians the same way or did persecute Christians as Nero did. That was not true. The most able of their emperors, like Marcus Aurelius, Domitian, Diocletian, were the most violent persecutors of Christians because they saw Christianity as a threat to the empire. Because it gained so much strength from the martyrdoms. And of course, some of the things would be absolutely cruel. I mean, I went to the Colosseum, you've seen pictures of the Colosseum, and to think that something like 90,000 people would look on, it's not as big as the MCG, but it has the capacity to hold that many people. And to see them, to have them screaming and yelling and seeing blood, you know, could you just imagine your son coming, he's 18 or something. Dad, Mum, I saw the fellow, he just cut off his head and held it up like this. Could you? And the crowds, you know, and going, there's blood sports. This is what the Roman emperors did to please the people of Rome. And of course, Christians were martyred. Christians were set in the stage with being torn apart by animals. Could you just imagine it, what it was like? To think the mindset of people developing, the cold-bloodedness of them. And that's why we see with these Muslim extremists this same sort of cold-bloodedness that makes your blood cool. And yet, even in these persecutions and the martyrs, there were those who looked upon these gory events and their hearts were touched. And they cast in their lot with these same people. Finally, the emperors of Rome climaxed with Diocletian's last attempt to destroy the faith of Christians. And when you read in Revelation, the second church, the Church of Smyrna, it speaks about you will have persecution 10 days. It referred to Diocletian's 10 years of diabolical persecution to rid the whole empire of Christians, but it failed. Then we come to Constantine, a new face, who ultimately popularized and supported outwardly Christianity. But it was a Christianity which became a mix of Christianity and paganism. So it wasn't true Christianity. But before that time, apostasy started to develop in the Christian church where the development of the bishops took place. And instead of bishops being what we'd call elders or ministers, they became powerful in themselves. And they started to dictate how the church would be run. And ultimately, bit by bit, paganism started to be incorporated into the worship. And when Constantine came, paganism started to sweep into the churches. A degrading development of faith and belief of Christianity. But ultimately, it wasn't so long before persecution started to develop even within Christianity itself. Just like what had happened before. This is what you'd have. The union of church and state. Whatever the church was, or religion was, and the state, that is the government, together combining to enforce these things. The ultimate apostasy came with the development of church and state after the fall of the Roman Empire. And then we know of the development of the papacy, the Bishop of Rome becoming the primary bishop. And this is talking about the Western Empire of Rome, because the Eastern Empire became a separate entity. Then what was followed was the Dark Ages, the medieval period, etc. And the control of human lives by the dictates of the church and the state. And I brought it in the car, but I tell you what, it's a very good thing to view. It was one of the best things that our church ever did, and it was done by Australians, You've heard Keepers of the Flame, the first episode called The Apostasy. It's well worth seeing because it shows how these things developed, how we see the apostasy develop in the church, and ultimately all those different things that had no bearing from the Bible became incorporated into the Christian church. And ultimately, of course, came with that conformity. And if you didn't conform, there was the problem soon developing of persecution for those who failed to follow that. And of course, ultimately, the picture of torture, burning at the stake, and so on, was a rite of passage to those who didn't conform. That happened in Western Europe. Eastern Europe suffered something different. The rise of Islam took place in around 600 AD and counteracted much of Christianity or a pagan Christianity as a result. But it was a rival religion who did the same thing, persecute those who didn't agree with it. And we see it today, of course, in its worst form. Now, we come to the Reformation. And some people have the idea that once the Protestant Reformation came to being, that people had religious liberty. Wrong. That didn't happen just like that. You have to understand the situation. These men came from a background, historically knowing nothing else but church and state uniting. And those ideas were still with them in many ways. The early reformers, in some ways, tried to advocate individual response, but they didn't know how to construct a society whereby that could take place. Luther took the idea that how you would deal with that is you would become the member of that part of, we could say, not a county, but a province, whereby you took the religion of the prince that was in control of that state. So if he became Lutheran, you would follow the Lutheran religion. Okay? If your prince was a Catholic, you became Catholic. So if you wanted to go to become a Protestant, you moved out of where the Catholic prince was, or where a Protestant prince was and you wanted to stay Catholic, you moved into that. Now that, of course, created a lot of problems. And that's how they had it. That was Luther. Calvin designed a city-state type of thing, still very much a religion of church-state. Smaller entities, but there was no religious liberty under Calvin, let me tell you. And Calvin devolved one of the most hideous beliefs that ever could be developed, and that was predestination. That where some people are predestined to be damned, to be persecuted, not to be persecuted, to be writhing in hell forever and ever. And they had no choice in the matter. Ridiculous. And others would be saved no matter what they did, virtually. But the problem arose with the subject of infant baptism. Soon as you have infant baptism, you mean that you are already a member of the church, whichever state you're in, whether Catholic, Protestant, and you really don't make any decision for it. But the Anabaptists had the idea of baptism by immersion by those who had the understanding of what they were doing. That created a problem because now you could no longer have a state, you know, a group of people, well, a group of many, many people who choose the religion to follow the religion or not by adult baptism or baptism near to adult, if you could say what I understand. And so you had this problem. It took a while for Protestantism to come to grips with the freedom to allow people to choose whether they serve God or not. when you come to some of these things, you find it difficult to sometimes understand. Not long after the Protestant Reformation began, the Counter-Reformation took place in Catholic lands, which tried to bring back or gain back what they had lost to Protestantism. And there was much bitter conflict and war and fighting over it. And Germany, for example, was divided between Catholic and Protestant. France rejected the Protestant reforms in 1572 with the St. Bartholomew's massacre. The Dutch fought against the Spanish Catholicism. They were called the Sea Beggars, and they ultimately retained pockets of Protestantism, mostly Calvinism. And so you have these two things. But there was not the idea of freedom of religion as we know it. That took a while to develop. Let's follow with England. There was Henry VIII. He was very pro-Catholic until it came to the divorce of Catherine of Aragon to marry Anne Boleyn. And then he threw his off the yoke of Catholicism and developed his own church. The head of the church would be the king. And the church would follow. But it was not very different from Catholicism, let me tell you that. Anglicanism at the time was very close to Catholicism at the time. And there was not the total freedom of choice either. But particularly trying to keep both groups happy, both Catholic and Protestant, within England, was a difficult job. And when it came to Henry VIII dying and I've forgotten the next name, the next king, who was only a young fellow. I've forgotten his name. When he died young, he was very pro-Protestant. I've got so many names I can't remember them at all. And then Mary came onto the throne. She was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. When she came to the throne in 1553, she turned back the whole nation to Catholicism. And she had some 300 martyrs burnt at the stake who were remained Protestant. So there was no religious freedom. Then, of course, we know that no other than the daughter of Anne Boleyn became Elizabeth I. Now, she had a long reign from about 1558 to 1603. And she brought back, knowing, because of the conflict that would exist if she didn't bring back Protestantism, and she brought back Anglo-Catholicism. It's an Anglican Protestantism, if you could put it that way, which is very much like Catholicism. And this they tried to satisfy both the Catholics and the Protestants within the nation of England. And, of course, she had the idea that it wasn't her duty to look into people's minds to see what they were thinking or what they believed. And she, you know, they was trying to please them all. But there arose, in the time of Elizabeth, Puritans. They were mostly Calvinists. And there arose a clash between Anglicanism and the Puritans. You have then after the first Stuart king, you have ultimately Charles I arises. And there you have him supporting Anglicanism, and then you have the Puritans supporting a much more rigorous Protestantism. And ultimately that came to a clash with the British Civil War, the English Civil War, in which Cromwell and Charles I clashed in war. And ultimately Cromwell won. And Charles I was beheaded. And so there developed takeover of Protestantism of a Puritan type. But that didn't last long. It was 1660 when Charles II came king, and back to it was to Anglicanism again. And then, of course, during this time, of course, people had difficulties who didn't agree with any of these things. And they were persecuted even in a so-called Protestant land. And of course you've heard of the Pilgrim Fathers who left in the 1620s going over to America to worship as God as they saw fit. But after that time you have, after time of Charles II, you have James II comes to the throne and he wants to bring back Catholicism into England. And of course there was a conflict that ended in a war, and ultimately they brought over from the Netherlands William of Orange, establishing again Anglicanism as the main religion of England. So you see these sort of things. But there wasn't the freedom that you think that they had. But ultimately, the power of Parliament arose. And more freedom started to be given to the peoples to think as they wished. And when you look at what has happened in Europe, you see that this conflict between Catholic and Protestantism went on for a number of years. Before what was happening in England, there developed between 1618, I wished I had a timeline, I usually like to draw out a timeline, you see that I'm going back and forth, and it's very hard, as I said, it's a bit difficult to follow. But if you can see the point that I'm trying to make, you get the point. There developed the 30 Years' War, developed from 1618 to 1648. This is before Charles II. This is the time of Charles I. But this was fought in Europe between Catholic and Protestant. These were the most horrible wars that could have been in that a time that took place. And they mostly fought in Germany for Protestants to retain what they had gained, or for Catholicism to regain what it had lost. These wars were fought out on the battlefields of Western Europe. Wallenstein ultimately became the general in charge of the Catholic forces, and Gustavus Adolphus from Sweden became the one who led the Protestant forces, and ultimately the Protestant forces won. And thus, the rights of toleration were given to those who were Protestant to remain Protestant, and those to be Catholic remain Catholic. And ultimately, people were sick and tired of the wars of religion. And they wanted just peace and to be able to worship God as they wished. Whereas in France, Louis XIV snubbed his nose at the Pope in one way, but maintained a strict Catholicism in his own nation. But he said, I will choose who I will have as cardinals and bishops, and they will run the church, Catholic Church, as I want it run, which was the same virtually, but not the Pope's control. By 1750, most people's interest in religion was really in decline. In France, there was a growing voice of the sceptics. And you've heard of people like Descartes, Voltaire. These were the satirists. And let me say this, that newspaper that the Islamists killed those writers, this was a newspaper that satirised just about anything. It satirised the Pope, the present Pope included. It satirised the Catholic Church, it satirised Protestantism, it satirised governments, it satirised fools and, you know, all sorts of things. It made satire of just about anything. So it was sort of a sceptical type of paper. But these people, these developments in France were satirising the Church in France, because they saw how it didn't fit. Well, we come to the modern era, and this is where our development of freedom of religion really comes in. Firstly, we go to the United States, the land that was supposed to be the freedom. When the Pilgrim Fathers and those others who migrated to America, what did they do when they got there? They did the same thing as what had happened from the countries that they had. They still tried to maintain religious persecution. You belonged to a church, you had to go to the church. You didn't have the right to not go to it. and so forth. And they developed that. It took a while before a fellow called Roger Williams set up a state called Rhode Island, which is a state, it's on the east coast, northeast coast of the United States, where he established the freedom of religion. The main city is called Providence. Would you believe that? Then you have the battle between the British and the Americans, the American patriots, trying to cast off the yoke of England. And in 1776, they began that. And then by 1789, they had written their constitution, which incorporated the freedom of religion, the separation of church and state. And the First Amendment, which is the American Constitution, makes this statement: Congress shall make no... I know it off by heart, but now I've got it. Congress shall make no... It actually codifies and says that Congress, that is the two houses, Senate and the House of Representatives, will make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's the First Amendment of their Constitution. It's a state without a king, and it's a church without a pope. Underlined there. Lafayette took that same idea and came over to France. And they wanted to incorporate the same sort of principles that the United States had. And in 1789, they stormed the Bastille, which was a prison in the city of Paris. And then they wanted to bring about the same sort of thing. But what had happened? The Paris mob took over, and there we developed the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror. And so there wasn't any freedoms either as a result, which was totally... This was taken over by skeptics and rationalists, etc., and so on. There was a problem there. Bonaparte took over from them, a war against Europe in the name of religion. But ultimately, what happened after 1798, and that's a very important date, as you and I know as an Adventist, world orders started to change. We saw the collapse of monarchies. We saw the collapse of kings and queens having power. We saw the freedom start to develop of civil and religious liberties take place. Started to. Far more. It marks that beginning. And it becomes enshrined in so many constitutions of so many governments, including Australian. Europe involved their own constitutions, which required separation of church and state, etc. There are glitches, of course. Just take Russia, for example. It wasn't until 1917 when the Russian people revolted and brought about Catholicism and communism, which was still non-freedom of religion. Only this time it was a non-religious power wanting conformity of its people. It wasn't until 1989-91 before people had the freedom in the Soviet Union to worship God as they wished, or not to worship him. Point that we find is a problem is that today you and I and most people who live in lands where there is religious toleration and religious freedom, we tend to take for granted and say that it will ever be. And you can see that the attitudes that are developing against these Islamic extremists should be to all the nations as a warning of what religious intolerance becomes. You know what I mean? They should see that this, what is happening, should give them a picture that if you go back to that way, what is going to happen? Wherever these Islamic extremists are, there is no choice for you. You live according to not only religion, but the cultural practices, etc., women have no place, they have no rights virtually, etc., etc. Even in many Muslim countries, they don't have these things. And many other who follow something like that. It should be a warning to the whole Western world that going back to the union of church and state is nothing but an absolute disaster. Yet as I read the book of Revelation, and you and I know, that's exactly what will happen. Exactly, only not in little pockets, but it will be worldwide. And if you and I are alive in that time when it happens, we will be the ones on the end of those lack of freedoms and persecution. I could go through the biblical basis for religious liberty. I could go through the religious examples. And there are numerous ones. And we sometimes ask ourselves when we read some of the scriptural statements, Paul makes statements about that governments are established by God. And we ask ourselves, well, did really God establish Caligula, Nero, Genghis Khan, Hitler, Stalin, etc.? We have wonders about that. And yet, that's what he says. But you notice that those people who did that didn't last long. Although Stalin did. He's the longest lasting one of any of them. Or Genghis Khan might have. But, in Daniel 2:21, Daniel stated to Nebuchadnezzar, it is he, God, who sets up kings and deposes them. And ultimately it's in God's control. We are lucky and very fortunate that we live in democratically elected government nations where we can choose who we have as leaders. And we're pretty quick at shoving them out too when they don't fit what we want. And aren't we fortunate to have that? Whether you'd agree which party, just think of it. If you had where one was control and you had no say in what happened and you had to just follow what was said, just how you'd feel. But we have that choice of being able to select. Many people in many nations have no choice whatsoever, unfortunately. Democracy is only a modern experience. But that democracy will go by the boards when the crisis comes. And it will be back to like the extremists that we see modern-day Islamics. Only it will be worse in the sense that it will be worldwide. Do not take for granted the freedoms you have. Do not take religious liberty as a right. But it is a right that we should have, but as a right that has to be strenuously upheld. Unfortunately, at the present time, we have that right, and the gospel message is still going forward. But there's coming a time, and it's coming very quickly, when that right will be taken away, and it will be a worldwide phenomenon. And there's only one thing that will protect us, and that is God and our union with him. We won't be able to call upon legislators. We won't be able to call upon the police to protect us. That won't happen. Only God is our protector. And ultimately, God will win. Thank you. Let's bow our heads. We take from the message of this last stanza of this hymn, when Christ shall come with shout of acclamation and take us home, what joy shall fill our hearts. Yes, and Lord, in that eternity to come, we'll adore thee for giving us the freedom to choose to worship you, to have cast in our lot with the people of God, with you, and to know that what you have for us is beyond our comprehension. that we will be so glad that we made the right decision. And we pray that this joy will be something we look forward to. We thank you that you give to us and have given us an opportunity of religious freedom, religious liberty. Let us treasure it, because it soon will be taken from us. But in that kingdom, there will be that freedom which we will never want to rebel. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.